Welcome to this episode of Heart Failure in Focus. I'm your host, Muthu Vadaganathan, and this podcast is hosted by Radcliffe Medical Education and is supported through an unrestricted educational grant from AstraZeneca. Please note this podcast is intended for healthcare professionals.
Welcome to this episode of Heart Failure in Focus. It's a delight to be joined by Professor Giuseppe Rossano, who's a professor of cardiology, consultant cardiologist at St. George's University Medical School in London, and really a world-renowned expert in heart failure and a global voice and advocate for patients with heart failure worldwide. So welcome, Giuseppe. Really excited to have you.
Thank you, Muthu. Thank you for having me.
We'll be focusing on heart failure with preserved ejection fraction today, perhaps one of the most enigmatic and challenging to treat disease states in across all biomedicine that has had recent strides in progress. And so no better than to tap into the expertise and knowledge of Dr. Rossano in tackling this issue. So in this issue, we really will like to deep dive into three pieces, three documents that were recently released related to HFpEF management in 2023. So the first was the ACC expert consensus decision pathway around heart failure preserved ejection fraction. Second was a scientific statement from the HFA, EHRA, ESC on the role of phenotyping. And finally, was the 2023 update of the ESC Heart Failure Clinical Practice Guidelines on the Management of Chronic Heart Failure, which notably had a number of advances and updates related to heart failure preserved EF specifically. So before we dive into these documents, I'd like to get your perspective, Giuseppe. Why has there been such tremendous interest recently around this HFpEF topic? We've rarely seen this many documents, this many guideline updates related to a single entity come forth so rapidly. So what's happening?
The main reason is probably related to the fact that now we have a clear evidence for a treatment, the SGLT2 inhibitors that work very well and has a clinical effect, clinically meaningful effect in patients with heart failure and preserved ejection fraction, as well in heart failure with mildly reduced ejection fraction. And this is always the case when you have a new therapy in a new therapeutic area. For many, many years, we've been very disappointed with the results of trials into patients with heart failure and preserved ejection fraction. And for this reason, also the diagnosis of heart failure with preserved ejection fraction has been left on a side. Part of that was also due to our fault because we made it too complicated with too many heart failure with preserved ejection fraction scores that you had to use in order to make diagnosis. So there was on one side a problem with making the diagnosis. On the other side, there was a problem of not having any tool that could have improved the quality of life, but also events and reduced mortality and events in patients with heart failure and preserved ejection fraction. So this is why there's this sprouting of new documents. And of course, there was a need of updating the guidelines. The ESC 2021 guidelines became old 4 hours after they've been presented, because 4 hours afterwards in the late-breaking trial, the EMPEROR preserved had been presented. And after a few months, then the liver trial came out, and so giving a strong evidence that there was a need to update the guidelines. And the same happened for the ACC document. But also then there was once you have a treatment, then there was a need to identify those patients who may benefit most for additional treatment. And so this is why I believe we have all these documents that came out more or less at the same time, more or less being concordant with each other.
Why don't we talk about these individual documents? And they came at around the same time in general in 2023. And so, but each of them are a bit different. And so the ACC consensus decision pathway really focuses on a number of different facets of HFpEF care, offers somewhat of a pathway and some recommendations of how individual components of HFpEF care can proceed. I'm happy to kind of provide a few more details, but maybe you can start with the phenotyping article and document. How do you see the role of that phenotyping document play out in current care?
I think that that is important, not mostly for the cardiologists, but also for the internal medicine, for geriatrics, for general practitioners that always face the complex patient, because patients with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction hardly have only heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. They have a background of comorbidities. And we identified all the most common comorbidities that needed to be more specifically investigated and more specifically treated in patients with heart failure. For this reason, we came up with a consensus document. The reason why we also had the European Society of Hypertension on board was because of the significant importance of arterial hypertension in patients with preserved ejection fraction, that in the recent trials from the liver to EMPEROR preserved, the ranges between 70 and 80% of patients, but also the need of identifying patients with obesity. There is a growing problem in amongst patients with heart failure, and for which now we have some signs of hope with recent studies with the GLP-1 receptor agonists. So what we thought was there was a good to have an indication to give a clear role for the SGLT2 inhibitors that should be central for the treatment of patients with heart failure, and then to identify all the most important comorbidities, and for each of the comorbidities, identify those treatments that are not just effective, but also are safe in patients with heart failure and preserved ejection fraction. Just one example, if we take the COPD, we gave indication for the use of the LAMA-LABA and the use of the beta-1 selective beta blockers. Because, for the if you gave a beta-2 agonist, that may increase the event rate in patients with heart failure. So you see, there was an indication for drugs that are safe, but also drugs that are effective because the beta blockers are effective in reducing mortality in COPD. The same for arterial hypertension. We gave an indication of specific drugs like, for example, indapamide, that is effective in reducing the occurrence of heart failure in clinical trials, specifically the signs in hypertension, and so on and so forth. So document was more to give a better clinical overview on how to treat patients with preserved ejection fraction and comorbidities, and especially on how to manage the specific comorbidities that sometimes can be approach with treatments that may worsen heart failure with preserved ejection fraction.
Yeah, so challenging in clinical practice. We have a litany of drugs that are included in these guideline documents that could potentially exacerbate heart failure, but in these intersections of comorbidities, often we are in the challenging situation that we may need to actually use that drug or an alternative drug and continue to manage their heart failure. So the ACC consensus decision pathway includes a number of pearls, but I think that some I'd like to highlight. One is the use of these scores, not just for the diagnosis, but also potentially to guide us of when we should be looking for heart failure mimics. And so in patients who have a clear syndrome of heart failure, but a low H2 PEF score, for instance, that patient, you might be wondering, could they have a heart failure mimic that may be responsible for their symptom presentation? Furthermore, there is really nice figures and sort of pathways that guide us about who we should be considering to recommend to refer from primary care to a cardiovascular specialist. There's this mnemonic check-in. C is for collaboration. H is for high-risk features such as heart failure, hospitalizations, pulmonary hypertension or RV dysfunction. E is for extensive evaluation needed. Do they need additional testing like invasive hemodynamics or cardiac MRI? C is for cardiorenal syndromes. Are they having worsening kidney function? K is for knowledge around HFpEF mimetics. So perhaps they have suspected concurrent valvular heart disease, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, amyloid, or pericardial disease. I is really increased need for diuretic agents, and N is NYHA classification 3 or 4 symptoms. So this is just a helpful structure that may allow us to triage patients from primary care to cardiovascular specialist. I know there are a number of other pathways and models worldwide, but this is one that was put forth. Furthermore, in terms of recommendations, we'll talk about the SGLT2 inhibitors in just a moment in the guidelines. The ACC consensus decision-making also recommends the use of second-line therapies like MRAs, ARNI, and ARBs, and loop diuretics in addition to SGLT2 inhibitors in select scenarios. And so, of course, in a congested patient, use a loop diuretic. In a patient who has an EF that's below normal, consider some of these other therapies like MRAs and ARNI, especially in women. So I think this is somewhat of a practical strategy, but I want to turn to the guidelines for just a moment. This is fairly rapid. We've seen 2021, the ESC guidelines, 2022, the ACC-AHA guidelines, and then again in 2023, the ESC update. And so at least in guideline time, this is actually a pretty rapid update and turnaround. And so I know that was a tremendous effort. So take us through those guidelines, Giuseppe, and especially as they relate to the SGLT2 inhibitors.
Yes. Regarding the ESC guidelines, I mean, the evidence coming from DELIVER and EMPEROR Preserved led to a recommendation of class 1A. Now, the class, of course, we have the two different silos of patients, the HFrEF and HFpEF, being the patients included in both trials, having 11 ventricular function rather than 40%, then there was a need of two different recommendations for HFmREF and HFpEF. Now, in HFmREF, there's a clear class 1A recommendation for the use of diuretics and SGLT2 inhibitors, dapagliflozin and empagliflozin, and then a class 2B for all other neurohormonal blockade, ACE inhibitors, ARNI, MRAs, and beta blockers. The reason for the class 2B recommendation is because the data on those drugs came mostly from sub-analysis of trials that were conducted in patients with reduced ejection fraction, or from negative trials, or trials that did not achieve fully their statistical significance. For preserved ejection fraction, there was just a recommendation for the SGLT2 inhibitors and diuretics if there is congestion as class 1A, but also there is a recommendation of class 1 for screening for cardiovascular and non-cardiovascular comorbidities. Then the guideline, that was a focused update, so it didn't dig too much into details of the specific comorbidities, but gave an indication saying, look, if you find that there is an 11 ventricular ejection fraction greater than 50%, there's a clear diagnosis of heart failure, then you need also to look for the comorbidities. And this is why then we use the additional algorithm in the position paper on phenotyping. My take on the two guidelines, just looking side by side, the American guidelines and the European guidelines, I think that they're quite concordant. I mean, if you look at the central figure on treatment of the ACC-AHA guideline, it went from orange to orange with a border, with a green border, that may hint that there's a basically a sort of concordance of what the ESG guidelines gave as class one recommendation for the SGLT2 inhibitors. Then pathway also, and that treatment includes class two for the ARNI, ACE inhibitors, and beta blockers that in the ESC guidelines are recommended for the 40 to 50% ejection fraction. So I think that there are just slight differences, but then the ACCHA guideline document also gives the different profiles, as you said, and it's in part concordant to what the phenotyping paper tells. So the treatment for specific condition, users of the different drugs in the ARNI, for example, or the ACE inhibitors or the diuretics when there is a specific need. So I think that, if you look at them globally, they tend to concur in having the central role for the SGLT2 inhibitors and the diuretics, and then in the need of phenotyping.
Excellent. So in the last few minutes, I'm going to really take advantage of your vision and ask you a couple of more philosophical questions. We've talked about three different guidance documents, many different societies involved in each of these guidance documents, tremendous national, international efforts to put forth these documents, but some differences, some similarities across these documents, and they're arriving around the same time. Do we need more global platforms for guideline documents that allow more perhaps harmony and more coordination across especially American and ESC as the two largest guideline bodies in putting forth recommendations?
I think that there will be a need in the future of having global guidelines that will take into account the needs of the different countries. Because until we will continue to write guidelines for rich countries, then we will only target just one proportion of patients with heart failure. Until we'll target only patients that are seen by very highly specialized centers, we will lose the grasp of the vast majority of patients with heart failure. So we need to bring on board the general practitioners. We need to bring on board the internist and the and also the geriatricians, because they are key in the continuity of care, and that is from one side. On the other hand, I think that there is a need for the scientific societies to go beyond the classifications, as I said earlier, in silos of heart failure, reduced, preserved, and mildly reduced, because there's nothing as stable. We have to look at more at how the trajectories for the individual patients within the journey in the heart failure, whether that patient is worsening, whether that patient is improving or remains stable. And in that case, I think that what is important is that now we have a class of drugs like the SGLT2 inhibitors that work all across the board. And we also have to realize that in many countries, and there is a problem in having an access to the echo. So sometimes it may take 3 to 6 months, and we cannot wait for 3 to 6 months to initiate our treatment. So we now can be, I think, quite confident whenever we see a patient where we have a clear clinical suspicion that is really heart failure, then we can start with the SGLT2 inhibitors and diuretics if there is congestion, whilst we await for the left ventricular function, and then fine-tune our treatment according to the different comorbidities and according to the left ventricular function.
Yeah, that is a great vision forward. And I think we've started this entire journey in heart failure, in which heart failure was largely synonymous with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction or advanced systolic dysfunction. But we've evolved to become quite a bit smarter, and we've learned more about the heart failure syndrome. But in doing so, guidelines now include four different left ventricular ejection fraction-based entities, reduced, mildly reduced, preserved, and improved ejection fraction, each with its own set of guideline recommendations, and perhaps that is becoming too complex, and perhaps there is going to be a not too distant future in which we move back towards the heart failure syndrome primarily, and then with a core guidance, subsequently, as you mentioned, tailored based on ejection fraction comorbidities. And I think that's a vision certainly that would simplify and streamline and facilitate implementation. So thank you so much, Giuseppe. This was a real treat to be able to discuss with you and to gain from you the wealth of your experience and expertise.
Thank you very much, Mutu, for having me. And I mean, we have to give you credit because most of the work on heart failure with preserved ejection fraction comes from you and your group. So you have a very central role in the future treatment of our patients.
Much too kind. We hope you all enjoyed today's episode of Heart Failure in Focus, produced by Radcliffe Medical Education. This podcast series is supported through an unrestricted educational grant from AstraZeneca. Thank you so much for listening.